this week's episode of the Just Publix at 365 podcast series. I'm your host, Heidi Knobloch, and today I'm going to be talking with Frances Fox Piven, Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Sociology at the Graduate Center CUNY. Today, we're going to be talking about her work in the development of the welfare state, political movements, urban politics, voting, and electoral politics. So without further ado, let's get to the interview. So I'm here with Professor Frances Fox Piven. Welcome to the show.
Glad to talk to you.
So I'm going to ask if we can do an impossible task in this 30-minute interview, which is to really trace the work that you've done over the course of your career. So the first work that I would love to talk about is The Weight of the Poor. So you published that in 1966, I believe?
Yeah, it was an article in The Nation, but before it was an article in The Nation, we mimeographed. At that time, people mimeographed. We mimeographed 20,000 copies of the article, not because we were self-promoters, but because the article was based on research, imaginative research, on the survey data on the failure of the welfare system, particularly aid to families with dependent children, our main cash assistance program at that time. And now we don't have a cash assistance program, basically, but then we did. And that it was based on research survey data that showed that there were at least twice as many people who were eligible for the program in the big cities as were actually receiving the cash benefits that the program permitted. So we thought, well, this is a time that something might be done about that. We've got a democratic regime in Washington, and the cities are pulsating with the, really the black movement had come north by 1965, 66. And this is a time where we might be able to mobilize all kinds of people, social workers, lawyers, community organizers, poor people themselves, to claim their full benefits under welfare. And that's what we then tried to do. That's why we mimeographed 20,000 copies of the article. And we also, of course, had lots and lots of meetings with lots and lots of organizers. And in a fairly short time, George Wiley had climbed on board, a number of other people had climbed on board. We had raised a little money, and we had begun the work that led eventually to the National Welfare Rights Organization and to a nationwide movement of poor women demanding, sounds so strange now, so odd, demanding welfare, demanding assistance. And you know, I believe then, I believe now, that they had a right to assistance. But part of what the movement did was to nourish their own hope and their own indignation at the way they were being treated, so that they developed the self-confidence to demand assistance for them and their children.
And that's an incredible example of how academic research can inform public policy. And when you were first doing that, because that was, you know, you were a pretty young scholar at that time. And as you were doing that work as a young scholar, what was that like? What was that experience like? Kind of what did you dream would happen? And how did what happened meet those dreams or kind of change them?
Well, I didn't so much feel myself to be a young scholar. This is 1965, and this was such a dramatic moment in the United States. I lived in New York City. I lived in Harlem, actually, on the border of Harlem. And you could feel the throbbing of the city, the throbbing of the community. I worked on the Lower East Side. I would go downtown to the Lower East Side. The streets were alive. People were so excited, so angry, so hopeful. and you turn on the TV and you'd see the footage of actions by the Southern Civil Rights Movement. I mean, this was so blinding, or illuminating, not blinding, I think, because the people who were participating in that movement in the South were people who were the most oppressed, denigrated, crucified people in the United States. And the courage that they showed, it was very exciting. It taught the people who participated in this movement and the other movements that were associated with it a lot that you can't learn from scholarship.
And your this excitement, you know, and it drove you, it seems, throughout your research. When, you know, I read the papers that you, I have to admit, I read them in the collection of your most recent collection. But one of the things that, you know, I felt in them was kind of this, what is the word I want to use? It was just such a visceral feeling that you rarely get from scholarship, you know, this... I felt like what I felt when I was reading, it was very important.
Well, scholarship can enable you to actually participate in your society instead of just to observe it and to scrutinize it. I think the observing and scrutinizing can be very useful, but it can be wrapped up with and driven by your participation and your participation together with others, linking arms with others in the effort to reverse, in this case, decades and decades of criminal injustice, really. And, a little bit later, the anti-war movement, or in also a mainly Southern movement for the right to vote that culminated in the Voting Rights Act, which has just now recently been crippled by the Supreme Court of the United States. But you can do other kinds of research too. You can stay down in the archives. And I don't criticize people who do that. They sometimes produce fascinating work. But my work is driven by the connections I feel with other groups in the society that are working to remedy the flaws, the injustices of our society, and particularly by low-income and working people who are mobilizing on their own behalf.
That's wonderful, and I find that incredibly, incredibly moving, because I agree that there are some people that work in the archive, and, you know, there are some people who don't, and I happen to be one of those people that tends to work in the archive and peek my head up every once in a while, but I very much admire scholarship, and you can really sense it when you read it, scholarship that goes beyond that with an effort to talk to society in general and engage with the society. But you mentioned, and I would love to ask you a question about the voting legislation, because you did work on the Voters' Rights Act, and I would love to hear about that work. So I guess the best way to ask this question is the voters' rights stuff. You worked on that for a long time and saw that scholarship connect to, you know, real world changes. So could you speak a little bit to that?
I'd love to. The Southern Civil Rights Movement was animated in part by what is the almost the mythical belief of black people historically in the United States and still today in the importance of the right to vote. And that movement had two main goals. One was desegregation. And the other was the right to vote, winning the right to vote for black people. They had been promised that right by the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments to the Constitution. But, of course, the accommodation that was reached with the South after the Civil War gave the Southern states the room and the right, the ability to strip African Americans of the right to vote. Almost totally in the South, and when they came north during and after the Second World War, they had limited rights to vote. In 1980, Ronald Reagan won the election for the presidency of the United States, and he won it on a platform that basically invoked what had always been the Southern strategy of doing politics, to use blacks as a scapegoat, to invoke blacks to scare whites into voting for them, Southern bourbon politicians. And Reagan has since brought that strategy north, and he made it national. He used blacks, he used synonyms for blacks in the American mind, like crime, welfare, the Great Society, or he used all of these symbols as part of his campaign, and he won the election with a very conservative platform, and he governed in a very conservative way. But that election, and especially the election of 82 and 84, made us pay attention to electoral politics more than we had before. And we began in going back through the political science literature, the academic literature, through the theoretical and empirical research which tried to explain why people don't vote, why some people don't vote, why poorer people don't vote, why minorities are less likely to vote. We came to the conclusion that the voter registration system was a very important, had created a very important set of barriers, and that it in fact had been designed at the turn of the 20th century to inhibit voting by, at that time, immigrant populations. So we had a kind of idea about how that might be changed. We thought that if voter registration were widely available at social service agencies that serve poorer people and disabled people, that we might circumvent the voter registration system. Now that revealed how naive we were about the arcane and complicated systems of voter registration, which are different by state, by county, all over the United States. And we were naive also about the multiple ways in which volunteer voter registration efforts can be foiled. But nevertheless, we did set out in a campaign to reform the voter registration system nationally. I mean, it's not a national system, it's a county system, to reform it nationally. And we eventually, after 10 or 11 years, we succeeded in putting together a coalition that won legislation that overrode, we hoped, we naively, again, we were much too optimistic, overrode these county and state obstructions to voter registration. When I say we were much too naive, we thought that we had in the legislation requirements that we thought would force implementation. But we thought that if the agencies had to report to a national election agency, and that the data they reported showed flagrant non-implementation, that would provoke Justice Department action. We were wrong about that. We had to litigate. We've been working on that, and I'm still working on that, on getting the working on the implementation of the National Voter Registration Act.
Yeah, and I would love to hear your thoughts. You know, the Supreme Court decision came down just a few days ago.
Well, you know, people think that American society, indeed even world society, is in a sense progressive, that there's a kind of unfolding of improvements, that we learn more, we become morally more accountable, more responsible, and that gradually things get better. There's nowhere is it writ that that shall be so. And it is not so. We have had periods of terrible reversal, the reversal of measures that have brought a certain degree of social justice, economic justice to the United States, a certain degree of accountability in our criminal justice procedures. And again, you see these reversed. You see the improvements that we've made with regard to democracy reversed. In fact, we've seen some very sharp reversals, mainly but not entirely, through the Supreme Court. What the Supreme Court did, both with the Citizens United decision and with this new decision on sections 4 and 5 of the Voting Rights Act, is it gives license to the most conservative and predatory elements in American culture to work their will. In Citizens United, it was big money pouring into the election system, and in the case of the voting rights decisions, they've allowed the states and the counties even to disenfranchise those groups, African Americans and Latinos, with voter IDs, with shortened registration periods, to disenfranchise those groups that are more likely to vote for the politicians who will represent the mass of working and poor Americans.
Yeah, and I would just like to ask you, I guess a very, maybe a naive question myself, an optimistic question. For, you know, all scholars, young and old, you know, how do we fix the flaws in American society through doing academic research?
By connecting with social movements and by developing your research in a way that is responsive to and sensitive to the aspirations and indignities that the social movements are preoccupied with. I've done that. I don't think everybody has to do it, but I think it produces useful scholarship, and it, I have to tell you, it also gives you a very good life, a life of effort and comradeship and disappointment and then effort again, and the sense that maybe you're making an imprint on your world.
And then the final question that I'm sure that all of our listeners are going to be thinking when they hear your name, you know, I'm sitting here with the professor that Glenn Beck loves to hate. How has your research been interpreted by right-wing conservative groups?
Well, there's a, I suppose, a kind of formula for treating research, or it could be news coverage, it could be teaching. There's a formula for sort of isolating, targeting, and demonizing people who you don't agree with. And the media, especially Fox News, Glenn Beck was on Fox News, he had hours and hours and hours on his Fox News show. There's I think, a formula. You tell people who are a little bit befuddled, because the world is a complicated place and it gets all the more complicated as time goes on. They're befuddled, they're anxious. You tell people, oh, there, I know who is to blame for what's gone wrong with America. I know who is to blame for the fact that the society is changing. I know who is to blame for the fact that men don't act like men anymore and women don't act like women anymore. I know who is to blame for the fact that your neighbor's houses are being foreclosed upon. You pick out scapegoats. Where did we see scapegoats become very important in politics? Well, of course, that's fascism, isn't it? And it is a formula for fascist propaganda, but it's also a formula for propaganda more generally. And none of Glenn Beck's listeners knew or cared who I was or who I don't think they knew that I was alive, to tell you the truth. They knew that my partner was dead, or maybe they didn't. So they could create these characters and tell these stories about how America went wrong. Well, you know, that's propaganda in the worst sense of the word, because that isn't how America went wrong. There is a lot to be said about why the United States has as many problems as it does today, but it certainly doesn't have to do with the fact that Richard Cloward and I did research on the failure of the welfare system to provide benefits to the people who it was mandated to help in the 1960s.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a wonderful interview.
Thank you.
Well, that was this week's interview with Professor Francis Fox Piven. Join us next week for a conversation with Joseph Strauss on his work on disability in music. Have a great week. Just Publics at 365 is a project of the Graduate Center CUNY, located at 365 Fifth Avenue, where you will find the life of the mind in the heart of the city. Just Publics at 365 is funded by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.